This past spring, Lyle Goldstein did something he hasn't done in a long time. Well, a long time for him. He made a trip to China.
Now, it's my first time to Asia in 5 years.
Lyle is a visiting professor of international and public affairs at the Watson Institute's China Initiative. He's an expert on both China and Russia. And the reason for this trip was to learn more about the state of China-Russia relations right now and how the war in Ukraine has affected these relations. And even before Lyle gets to China, he starts to notice, compared to his last trip to the country,
a lot of things feel strange and different.
Even the flight was a reminder to Lyle that we're in a very different world than we were 5 years ago.
Flights used to fly directly into China. They would fly over Russia, actually, and right over the North Pole.
Most commercial flights have been banned from Russia's airspace since the war in Ukraine began.
Now, you see most of the flights are flying through Japan or Korea and flying considerably longer and further to the south. So, I mean, that to me is a sign of the new world we're in.
A new world which also has echoes of the past.
Flying Korean Air, I couldn't help but remember that terrible tragedy where a South Korean airliner was shot down by the Soviets in, I believe it was 1987, with huge loss of life and really fomented all kinds of tensions. But flying right over that area made me think about the tragedy of Cold War and how that seems to be spreading once again.
But according to Lyle, unlike during the Cold War, the biggest threat to our planet today isn't to be found somewhere between the United States and Russia. The real danger lay in a different relationship. His cab driver, once he landed in China, seemed to agree.
Coming into Shanghai, getting in the cab, the first question out of the cab driver's mouth after he asks where I'm from, he says, "So is there going to be a war between our two countries?"
And while neither Lyle nor anybody else can answer that question, he does feel confident that he knows where it would start if it were to happen. An island roughly the size of Maryland, about 100 miles off the coast of mainland China.
The most dangerous flashpoint in the world by a good margin.
On this episode, the third in our escalation miniseries from Trending Globally, why a military conflict between the U.S. and China over Taiwan is closer than it has ever been, why it's such a terrifying prospect, and what might be done to avoid it. As Lyle put it,
U.S.-China conflict over Taiwan did not seem probable 10 years ago.
So, before we look at what's changed in the last 10 years or so, and why the danger of this crisis is so great right now, let's take a quick refresher on how this island became such a fraught territory in the first place. You could fill libraries on the subject, but we'll keep it brief. Let's start back in 1949.
The People's Republic came into existence in 1949. It was at the end of the Chinese Civil War.
The communist regime known as the People's Republic of China, or the PRC, won that civil war and came to rule the country. The United States, however, had supported the other side in that war, the previous ruling government of the country, known as the Republic of China.
The civil war was resolved by the regime that the U.S. had supported for decades and had a lot of close ties with, fleeing to Taiwan.
The communist PRC has ever since then claimed that Taiwan is a territory of their country. A significant part of Taiwan's population, though, sees it differently. Not just that they are independent from the PRC, but that they are, in fact, the true Chinese government. Now, in the 1970s, there were a series of breakthroughs in this fraught triangle between the PRC, Taiwan, and the United States.
When President Nixon arrived in China after a period of war and extreme tension and resolved many issues, that was back in 1972, almost all of the negotiations in that sensitive period from, you know, roughly 1971 all the way through 1979, almost all those very delicate negotiations revolved around Taiwan's status.
In the process, China made a few things crystal clear that it would require from other countries as it relates to Taiwan.
One aspect of China's red line is any stationing of foreign troops in Taiwan is a violation of Chinese sovereignty. That's how they put it. Other aspects of this would be if Taiwan were to declare independence formally.
And outside of these red lines, the political and legal murkiness around Taiwan has persisted to this day. The United States, along with most other countries in the world, doesn't officially recognize Taiwan as a country. Doing so would ruin any country's relationship with the PRC. That said, the US and many other countries do have close economic and informal political ties with Taiwan. As Lyle puts it,
in effect, the United States has been caught up in the Chinese Civil War. You could argue that really persists to this very day.
And with some regularity, every once in a while, the murkiness around Taiwan's status and the tension behind it bubbles to the surface.
There have been now many Taiwan crises going back to 1954, 1958, 1996. These are all instances in which the U.S. and China very well could have come to blows over Taiwan.
This past year, tensions around Taiwan flared up again. But this time, according to Lyle, is different from all the others. This is where we get into the bigger picture, because there are a number of overlapping events and trends that have made this current moment feel so dangerous to observers like Lyle. The first thing, starting, 6 years ago or so, you might have noticed that a lot of rhetoric coming from the U.S. towards China got a little more antagonistic.
I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator.
We can't continue to allow China to rip our country, and that's what they're doing.
We built the greatest economy in the history of the world. We were forced to close it because of the China plague that came in. And I've been as nice as I can, as long as I can, but we got to get some balance.
The precipitous downturn in U.S.-China relations, I would date that really to the Trump administration.
And thus far, his successor, President Biden, hasn't made repairing these relations much of a priority. So that started China and the U.S. down a slightly rocky road compared to where they had been in the years prior. And then in 2019, something happened that shook the relative stability that had existed between China and Taiwan.
One more piece here that I think is worth understanding in the Taiwan context is the shadow of the Hong Kong crisis.
In 2019 and 2020, residents in Hong Kong started to protest mainland China's efforts to change extradition laws between Hong Kong and mainland China. Protesters saw it as an overreach of China's authority on the island. The PRC put down the protests, at times violently. And according to Lyle, this marked a change in how China viewed their relationship to Hong Kong, which then had implications for Taiwan. And that's because for decades, China had used a similar template for both islands in relation to the PRC government.
Formerly, China's policy had been this, what we say in Chinese, one country, two systems. And that was the formula that Deng Xiaoping had come up with to resolve all of these problems.
All of these problems being different territories.
Different territories, right, which China wanted back. And these involved not just Taiwan and Hong Kong, but interestingly also Macau. That formula was to allow, you know, a good measure of autonomy, but still under the larger tent of China.
But after the crisis in Hong Kong,
the sense was in Beijing that this formula, which they hoped, I think, would work, would allow, you know, peaceful unification has, in their view, fallen apart completely. And, you know, that would leave much more forceful options for them.
And in Taiwan,
tensions built up considerably after that. People on the island, you know, sort of changed their calculations in many ways. They became much more frightened of Chinese power. And I think that caused them to take some more kind of radical steps away from the mainland's embrace, let's say.
Steps which China was loath to accept. Which then brings us to a third factor that brought us to this current moment of crisis. One that has gone on sort of in the background of all of this. That's been occurring over the course of decades.
Everybody knows China is rising, has risen. It's a much stronger country. When the US and China faced off over Taiwan in the 1950s, Chinese power could not compare, not even close. Even that was true, I think, in the 70s and even really in the 90s. Well, things have really changed in the last couple of decades.
According to Lyle, it might not be so much that China's views towards Taiwan have changed recently, as has China's sense that they now have the ability to act on those views.
As I observe Chinese pressure on Taiwan, it's been pretty consistent. And over the years, you know, it would maybe be ratcheted up, maybe pulled back occasionally. But, you know, with China's increasing power, we've seen more, you know, exertions, more exercises, more constant presence of Chinese military aircraft in the aerial zones around the island. And that's the major change.
Whether China's feelings have changed or just their ability to express them, this escalation has made lots of experts like Lyle very concerned.
And the rhetoric, I would say, because I monitor this very closely in Chinese sources, but you have this, I would say, steadily increasing really since 2016 and reaching some pretty vitriolic levels. I would say I think most Americans are probably quite unaware of this because it doesn't enter into the Western media. But if you follow Chinese media as I do, it really is extremely disturbing.
But what really brought the China and Taiwan tension to the front of many American minds was something else that occurred thousands of miles away.
The Ukraine crisis.
The war in Ukraine reminded the world that countries we think we understand can still transgress in surprising ways. Many people started to wonder if Taiwan would be, quote, the next Ukraine. But the war in Ukraine has done more than just suggest some parallels. It has literally drawn China and Russia closer together.
China has certainly thrown Russia an economic lifeline and tried to make sure that the Russian economy is relatively intact, which it does seem to be.
And farther from the West.
Xi Jinping generally is much more favorable toward Russia. Here I would point out that, you know, for over a decade, the top military cadres in China have been training in Russian military academies. So, I mean, you know, when they, I think they imbibe a lot of Russian culture and Russian strategic thinking.
For many in China, all of this combined
creates substantial sympathy for Russia's plight. They feel like Russia is under unrelenting Western pressure. And from their point of view, China is under similar pressure.
Ukraine, Russia, China, Taiwan, these four places, symbolically and materially, have become more linked.
There's one Chinese strategist put it to me in Beijing a few weeks ago. He said, you know, if Russia were to collapse or to be defeated, all that pressure would be transferred to China. And then the pressure against China would be that much worse. So the strategist made the case that it's not so much that China needs Russia to win, it's that China needs Russia not to lose.
To be fair, Lyle also saw on his trip that just like in the United States, there isn't one monolithic view of the war in Ukraine.
You know, you have hawks in Beijing and you have doves. The doves, they are very important people in China. I should emphasize that. They're well-read. They travel in the West. They often have, you know, Western friends. We can summarize their perspective by saying that China should steer clear of Russia, should kind of disassociate to the extent it it's possible and should really focus on its links with the West and repairing them after the pandemic and other tensions over Hong Kong and so forth. So that's one perspective.
Unfortunately for those doves,
the alternative perspective, I think we could say, still has the upper hand.
China's economic and military growth, America's distancing from China, the crisis in Hong Kong, the war in Ukraine. It's taken countless things to bring us to this moment. But the end result is this. Over the last decade,
I guess you could say the calculations changed in Beijing, in Taipei, and in Washington.
Lyle saw signs of these changes in countless meetings and conversations while he was in China.
The atmosphere in U.S.-China relations, and in particular the Taiwan issue, kind of cast a dark cloud over the trip, in the sense that I was, on almost every occasion, I was getting all kinds of warnings, and people looked, truly distraught and worried about the future course of U.S.-China relations. You know, I had one very prominent strategist in Shanghai tell me that I asked him why China is building up its nuclear forces so rapidly. He said, because China is preparing for the worst case.
And by worst case,
I feel somewhat compelled to spell that out for people. Even a conventional military conflict between the U.S. and China would involve, I think, probably tens of thousands of American casualties, perhaps more, something like what we suffered over a decade in Vietnam. But they could be significantly worse. There seems to be a broad acceptance, both among American and Chinese strategists, that not only is it somewhat likely that there will be some kind of military conflict, and that conflict could quite plausibly involve the use of nuclear weapons. You know, then we are talking about hundreds of thousands of dead, maybe even millions. People are actively discussing this, but let's face it, nobody knows, and that could get out of hand. And we're talking about a war between two nuclear-armed superpowers, and that has never occurred before. That could be literally the end of the planet.
And unfortunately, the news somehow gets worse. That's because these threats, Lyle doesn't think they're 10, 20, 30 years away. They could just as easily materialize very soon.
Almost anything could start this. And, you have to realize now that there are dozens of interactions every week here between both Taiwan and Chinese military aircraft, let's say, ships at sea, but also U.S. and Chinese. So this is going on in areas proximate to Taiwan. And by the way, not just in Taiwan, but also in the South China Sea and in the Yellow Sea area. So, I mean, if you iterate these interactions over and over, you probably get some kind of accident. And Christ, we've had this already. But that posits a kind of accidental war, war by misperception or something like that. But that's not necessarily how this would go down. It's quite clear to me there is a possibility. I don't think it's a high possibility, but I think it's there, that China would, convince itself that it seeks reunification. I mean, we know that. There's absolutely no ambiguity there. But that it would move forcefully in the near term.
How near? Well, no one knows, but there are worrying signs coming across Lyle's desk every day.
Minutes ago, just before this interview, I was just looking at a Chinese article that was very disturbing because the article said this. It said, China has seen that the United States, has sent massive amounts of weaponry to Ukraine. It knows that it has plans in place. In fact, the orders are set to send similar vast quantities of armament to Taiwan. But here's the catch. This article in Chinese identifies very clearly that these shipments are massively delayed. So does that mean that there is a window here of maybe 2 or 3 or 5 years where some of this very advanced weaponry is on order but has not yet arrived? And therefore, China decides to move up its timeline and to attack tomorrow. To my estimate, the Chinese military is more or less ready for that, should it get the order.
Whether this month or later this decade,
I don't believe there's some sort of date that has been set. That's not my sense, although it is conceivable. But Xi Jinping has made it clear that this is a problem for China that he does not want to pass down through the generations, implying that he wants this resolved. We had better take his word seriously.
Lyle fears that instead of de-escalating this tension, the U.S. might be accelerating it.
And as we've understood from various journalistic reports, there are U.S. troops now in Taiwan. Now, they may number in the dozens, they may number in the hundreds, according to last reports. So if one takes a kind of legal interpretation of the Chinese words, then you could say that the red line has been crossed. I hope that's not the case. I fear that it might be the case, that probably has triggered a set of counter moves on China's part, whether it means that we're already spooling up for war, I couldn't say. There are signs of that.
It's easy in these conversations to zoom out to the global implications of everything and the grand strategy of it all. And that sort of stuff does, of course, matter. But Lyle also wants people not to forget that there is a real place with real people at the center of this crisis. And it's there, Lyle thinks, that we might start to find some clues for a different direction this all could take. On his way home from China this spring, Lyle made a stop in Taiwan.
Visiting Taiwan, I had some, the island definitely gave me some deep impressions. I mean, first of all, the beauty, as I'd been told, is truly astounding. One other impression I took from it was in Taipei, there's a very famous museum called the National Palace Museum, and it has a stunning collection of Chinese antiquities. I think they have tens of thousands of these extraordinary pieces. You know, to me, at that moment, you know, one truly understands how all-encompassing Chinese civilization is and how many on Taiwan take great pride in that, right? That's the whole point of that museum. It's not really about Taiwan culture at all. It's about Chinese civilization and all its achievements. So, I mean, you know, to me, I think it would be useful for my fellow Americans to visit that museum and sort of take in the sense that the island, you know, does have clear affinities. They may be more on the soft culture side, but this may kind of encourage creative thinking in how Taiwan and China can, as it were, function together. Maybe that's more in the kind of cultural, linguistic, you know, areas, but that they can have very close ties that can persist whatever arrangement they come to govern themselves and their relationship.
Lyle thinks we can also find clues for how to de-escalate this tension in another place, Ukraine. Specifically, the lessons that the U.S. has learned from the war there.
I think skillful diplomacy could have avoided the war in Ukraine. I know that's a very controversial point, but I think the war could have been avoided. And I think the war with China over Taiwan can also be avoided. How? Well, one of the things I think that we can learn from what happened in European security is that we allowed a situation to escalate and escalate over time, and it became a situation where, there was NATO on one side and Russia on the other, and began to regard one another as grave threats, as an enemy. And the problem at the root of it is a kind of security architecture for Europe that had Russia on the outside, that was designed to isolate and contain Russia. And to me, that was a setup for war at the most fundamental level. The same thing is going on in the Asia Pacific. And I think if we continue in this course, we will arrive at the same result, and the consequences could be much, much worse, actually. So we need to have a different security architecture for the Asia Pacific, and that security architecture should be inclusive of China. It should not create a kind of Asian NATO, and we have to engage with China, and we have to encourage engagement within the system, that is between the key players. We should want Japan and China to reconcile. We should want good relations between Philippines and China, or Australia and China. From what I see in American diplomacy, it's inclined toward the opposite, meaning every kind of bit of bitterness in these relationships redounds to the U.S. benefit. We get better basing. We get more access, whether it's in Tokyo or in Manila or Canberra. We want to, we're trying constantly to fold the Indians into our kind of anti-Chinese alliance structure. This is a mistake. I think we need to be take a different tack, pursue engagement, try to be inclusive, and use clever diplomacy here. And force should be the last resort.
Why do you think that view that you just explained, why do you think that that isn't the dominant view among, policymakers and strategists regarding all this? Like, given the incredible risks involved of an escalation with China, why are there still being steps taken that seem to escalate it further?
I can't quite explain why this has come about, but a number of us in the field have recognized that back in the Cold War, people sort of glimpsed the possibility of the apocalypse in 1962. And we got a very powerful and very scary perspective on that. And we were all too close. And as we know now, we were much closer even than people thought we were. And that seems to have had a huge impact on a generation of American decision makers, even within military circles. And that caution lasted, I think, for a period of decades. But as I've observed with some colleagues, we just don't see that caution anymore. It seems to have dissipated almost entirely. And we see a lot of reckless behavior on all sides. That is one reason I'm so disturbed about the evolution, the current trajectory of this crisis, this kind of casual dismissing of the risks, which, as you pointed out, are almost unfathomable. But, we still have to talk through them and take appropriate measures. I mean, we only have one world, to put it very bluntly.
What did you tell that cab driver back when he asked you if these two countries were going to go to war?
I told him that the American people want peace and that it's a delicate situation. And I and others are working hard to prevent that. And I think that hopefully it will not happen.
As Lyle sees it, the threats are very, very real. But they are not a foregone conclusion.
We need to maintain military deterrence in the sense that, we should maintain strong armed forces. I worked for the Navy for 20 years, so I'm on board with that. I've seen the details of that. I've made recommendations to ensure that we maintain, a strong Navy and so forth. But we need to balance that with very thoughtful diplomacy and cautious diplomacy, which seeks for compromise. And there are compromises to be had. People often forget that, like I said, a decade ago, Taiwan's relations with the mainland were in a very positive place. People forget that. We can get back to that. We just have to be thoughtful about it.
Lyle Goldstein, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. My pleasure.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by me, Dan Richards. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps others find us. And even better, tell a friend about us. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for guests or episodes, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. That's all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks.